I'm Louise Darmody, interviewing Warren Clark for the New South Wales State Library's Oral History Collection. Today, Warren will share with us his life story and particularly his experience with the repatriation of Mungo Man and ancestral remains at Lake Mungo. The interview is taking place at Mildura on the 19th of November 2017. Warren, can you give us your birthday and where you were born? Birth date and where you were born?
Yeah, well, I was born in Wilcannia, New South Wales. I lived most of my life in Ivanhoe, but my birth date is 30th, 04, 53.
It's been a really big week this week, Warren. After many, many years on your behalf and many other people's behalf, I think it's 43 years, Mungo Man has been brought back from Canberra to his burial ground at Lake Mungo. Can you tell us about the first time you heard about Mungo Man and Mungo Lady?
I reckon I read about Mungo Man when I was a young man, when I was in Ivanhoe, because I was always a keen reader and growing up in a small community, there wasn't much to do, like Ivanhoe, New South Wales, where I grew up, spent all my younger days, and I read an article in a paper that they found an old Aboriginal remains at Mungo, Mother Belinda Lake, then it wasn't a national park, and they took him away, and I was thinking, what reason, why would they do that?
Have you heard about Mungo Lady as well?
Yeah, it's probably a couple of years before that. They took away the Mungo Lady. As I said, I was a keen reader. And I was thinking, why would they do that sort of thing? Why would people allow them to take them human remains away from their country?
And so when was your first involvement with what was going to happen to the remains?
I suppose I spent 25 years working on the railways, New South Wales railways, in different positions. And then in 96, I applied for the job with National Parks and Wildlife Service down at Mungo National Park. And I was lucky enough to gain a job as a senior field officer out there.
So by this stage, the area where Mungo Man had been found and Mungo Lady had been declared a national park?
Yeah, that was they declared it as a national park in 74. So it was going for a few years when I became senior field officer out there.
And so what did your work entail when you first started?
Mainly the maintenance of the park itself, you know, the visitor facilities and fencing and the general duties like fox baiting and feral animal control and weed spraying. There's a wide range of duties you had to perform out there, and jack of all trades you needed to be. So I really enjoyed the position as senior field officer. And then after 8 years, there was another job come up within National Parks. It was the executive officer for Mungo Joint Management Advisory Committee. I'm a really outdoors person, and I didn't think I'd be suited in the role as, you know, behind the counter and messing with computers and stuff like that. But I love working with the elders. So when I was working with the three traditional tribal groups in the joint management of Mungo National Park, as I said, I was sort of looking after the park in my other role. But this role, I was doing it with the Aboriginal community, and
you took that on.
It was a challenge. Eh? It was a real challenge for me, and I took that on. And I think we had one of the best joint managed parks in New South Wales. It was in 2005. Every national park manager and regional manager, they come out to see how we got on well with the landowners, the shires, because there's a lot of, you've got to build a lot of bridges with different types of people. And I think I was, I think I was quite good at it, but you know, I enjoyed talking to different types of people, and yeah, so it really worked well for me. And my manager at the time, I think she's still over there.
Who's that?
Oh, Joe Gorman, her name was, and we got on really well, and we weren't sort of boss and workmates, we were sort of work colleagues, you know, we worked well together, and so it was a good working relationship that really had it over there.
Yeah. And that's a special relationship, well, isn't it?
Yeah, it really
when
was.
You know,
yeah. Yeah.
And so, what did you enjoy about the work?
Probably the management of the park and the way getting Aboriginal people employed. My role was, excuse me. But I think my main role was to create employment for Aboriginal people, and we had a discovery program at the time, and there was white people running the discovery program, and it was supposed to be, and they were talking about Aboriginal culture and what they was telling the general public I didn't agree with, and just my old mother told me a lot about my culture before I even got a job at, even stuff on the ground and stuff she told me about.
What did she tell you?
Oh, about the different types of artifacts, like the shell middens. If there was a shell midden site, you'd walk on it and she'd show me that sort of stuff, and the old fireplaces. She explained to me about the antiquity, I suppose, the age of these old fireplaces, you know. And I said, no one was here that long. Mum, what's wrong with you? But the scientific mob proved that, you know, that we were around. She was trying to tell me that we were here for a long, long time. And,
so did you get into doing that at Lake Munger?
Well, we discussed it a lot, you know, the our Aboriginal sites and the way we manage our sites. And we talked a lot about his interpretation and the way we interpret our languages and culture around the park. There's three tribal groups, and there's a 70-kilometre drive tour, and there's probably not much Aboriginal. Oh, well, there's no Aboriginal input into the way that's managed. And while I was out there, I sort of tried to instigate a book or something for the 70-kilometre drive tour. We got in about 12 or 13 vehicles, all these old elders from the three different tribes, and I said, no matter what you see, if you recognise it as an edible plant or something we use to survive in the bush, pull me up and we'll record it. You know, so there's all types of things we did see and record at the time, and we were probably in a bit of a drought season when we were doing it, but there was a lot of bush tucker out there in the bush, and we was trying to record it on this drive tour and get the interpretation in their language. But I never completed the project, but it's something I was working on.
Yeah. Would you still be interested in working on that?
I'm sure I would, because we've got a booklet about this. I employed an artist, and I used to tell him, paint that tree for me, I draw that tree. And the artist wanted the story, I don't know why, but he wanted the story of these elders. And, well, it's not your story, it's not my story, you know, it's their story. And we'll put the, just draw the tree or whatever, you know, he was drawing it. So that's probably one of the reasons it didn't work, was because he wanted the story before he drawed anything. I couldn't understand why, you know, but he must have his reasons.
So did he end up doing the booklet?
Yeah, he done a booklet, and I think he's sitting over in the park then, one of the drawers, I don't know whether they saved it or not, but I'll give it to one of the World Heritage. There's two different units, you know, you've got the National Park and then you've got the World Heritage over there. And I used to work closely with the executive officer for the Land O'Lakes World Heritage area in my role as Munger Joint Manager and executive officer for the joint management. So it was, you know, we had to work closely because the World Heritage overlaps the National Park.
And what... You say your mum knew a lot about it. What tribe is your mum from? What are you?
She was a Barkindji person. Barkindji. It's probably down Pooncare. My old grandmother got married there. And I think 1918, she got married in Pooncare, my old grandma.
And how far is Pooncare from?
It's right on the Darling River, or the Barker, as we call it.
Yeah.
The old river's not the same now, but...
How far would that be from Mildura, Pooncare?
About 130-odd kilometres. It's on the Darling going towards Menindi and Wilcannia. Yeah, so they moved us, I don't know, moved them out of Pooncare down to Menindi. The government didn't.
So was your mum mission?
Yeah, old Pooncare mission, and they moved them from there to down to Menindi.
Another mission,
yeah. And I remember my old father telling me that they put him on a cattle truck. There's a heap of young fellas, when he's about 19, 20. They put him on a cattle truck and sent him to Sydney, then up to Queensland, and they put him in the cotton fields and fed him molasses. That's what he was telling me. They boiled this big drum of molasses up, and they used to feed him molasses and camp him in his dormitory.
Mm.
His old grey blankets, government blankets, what they had.
And what tribe was he from?
He's from the Barkindji tribe.
So can you explain some of the difference between the Barkindji and the Mudi Mudi? Are there great differences, or just from different areas?
Oh, it's probably not a great deal of difference. I think some of the language is quite different, the Mudi Mudi and the Barkindji language group, and some of the Nyimpa languages, there's some similarities in the language, and I think they're always married in to one another.
Yeah. And you said that your mum could speak...
Yeah, she speaks the Barkindji language fluently, but I grew up in a small community.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a town called Ivanhoe, New South Wales, and there was 10 of us in the family, and there were 5 boys, 5 girls. But one of the wage component wasn't much what my old man was in. He was only a fettler on the railway, but we never went without a feed, so there was always food in the cupboard. And
what were your mum and dad's names?
My father's name was Willie Clark, or William Clark, and my mother's name was Margaret. Well, when I got married, she was a Bugmy.
Yeah. And that's an interesting connection to Mungo Man, isn't it? Because it's... Was she related to Alice Bugmy, who was one of the first people to complain to the scientists about taking the remains of them?
Well, now the Auntie Alice said my mother and Auntie Alice were sisters.
So can you tell me a little bit about...
My old grandmother was Kate Wyman, or Kate Bugmy, that was her married name. She was a Wyman, and I spent a lot of time in Wilcannia with my grandmother, up in the... growing up as a young man, 15, 16, I used to go up to Wilcannia a lot. I liked Wilcannia. It was a great little town.
And was she Barkindji too?
She was a Barkindji person, and she could speak the language fluently. But being a young man, I wouldn't listen to her. And she was trying to learn me the language. I used to go fishing and swimming in the Bark or the Darling River. And it was always nearly in flood those days, and I remember there's a lot of water. And she told me, don't swim in that river, otherwise that big nutchie gets you.
What's a nutchie?
And the nutchie is our rainbow, he's our dreaming serpent. And I said, what's a nutchie? And then, nothing, no, there's no nutchie in that river, yeah. There's a big nutchie get you, boy. And she described this snatching out, you know, a big snake, and he lives in those deep holes, she's telling me, and the water's cold. And I'd often think when I'm diving down in the river, you feel that cold water coming on you. Well, he's easy, yes, I better get out of here, you know. And I'd go back, and she'd crack me for swimming in the river, you know. But I'd give her a couple of fish, and she'd relent a little bit.
Did you speak your Barkindji language when you were a little kid?
We weren't even allowed to sit around them old people when they was talking the Barkindji language.
Why not?
Because they didn't want to learn us the Barkindji language, just because they wouldn't, because they were frightened of the welfare system at the time. If you went to school speaking other than English, the Walfa would have come and forcibly took you away just for speaking the language. So my mother never but taught me the language, but my old auntie Ellis, bless her soul, she's departed now. My old mum's still living, but she's in the home. And my auntie used to come down and she'd teach me, and my mother'd catch it. No, teach them kids that, Ellis. You know, and she'd have a bit of a go about it and a bit of a row. And they right? They don't know nothing. You know, she used to try to teach us. So I picked up a few words and then I could understand.
Can you tell us some words?
Well, this is your Murrah, this is your hand, and
Murrah.
Porky had his ears, and then there's your Dartu, Meeky.
Eyes.
Yeah, and
nose.
Mindily,
what's
nose? Mindily.
Mindily.
Mindily. Yatru, your mouth. Yeah, so I picked up a few words, you know, yearly, years, and that.
And you were saying before it was sad that your mum didn't teach you. You sort of liked to
have. Yeah, I'd love to learn it. And even my kids, you know, that's always interesting in the language and teaching language. I couldn't, but I was just to show them what was on the ground and that sort of stuff. And a few words that I picked up, I'd try to tell them and that, yeah.
And your son, Kenny, has actually worked in national parks for many years as well, too, in this area.
Yeah, we shared office together over there for 4 years, so I reckon it was probably the best time of my life working, sharing office. He's in the same role as I was. And he was the executive officer for the Taru lands. And I used to often go out with him to the Taru lands and give him a hand on what he did. And he's quite a really good operator on the computer and he knows what he's about. And yeah, but it's a very stressful job, I suppose, dealing with our people.
Mm.
The more you do, I think, the more trouble you get in.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. You know, when we're really going good, at the peak, we had a fallout of the tribal groups. You know, some walked away from the table, and then two tribes were operating out there for a while in the joint management. But now I think they're back together. But like, they offered me redundancy and. A couple of years ago, and I took it. I was pleased to get out of it, really, because I couldn't see my position coming back as executive officer with the joint management. But they did start the World Heritage Advisory Group, which I'm pleased they did again. And they had the three tribal groups working together again out in, within the Woolander Lakes World Heritage area.
So over the 43 years that it's taken. So when you, your auntie Alice, she was one of the people with Alice Kelly who contacted the scientists in Canberra and the government saying, we want our remains back.
Mm.
Did she motivate you to also try and get the remains to come back?
We often talked about it at our committee, at this committee, but that's all we ever done, you know, to get up and go. Well, we talked about a big keeping place and we nearly had a funding for the keeping place with working with the National Parks Foundation, and we had Glenn Murcutt on board. He's an
architect,
designer, We had him on board. He came out and met with the elders and all of us, and he showed them the design of the building, and we just about had the funding, and then it sort of all blew up and
The funding evaporated.
Yeah, I don't know where it went to, but yeah, there was lots of funding there for it. So,
yeah. So now that Mungo Man is back at Lake Mungo, where is Mungo Man being kept?
There's a little dark, dank room out there, and I've been with parks, I suppose, for 19.5 years, and I can count how many times I've been into that room on one end. So I don't like the little room. It's where the Mungo lady is. She's in the safe there. And when people ask me, I don't tell them she's in the safe. I just tell them she's in a safe keeping place. It's better than saying she's locked in the safe in a dark little room. And
so
she's been there since 91, 92, I think they brought her back. And I think Badger Bates and Alan Thorne and the late Alan Thorne and Jim Bowler, they were instrumental in getting the Mungo lady back, and there was talk of getting the Mungo back, but it's taken all that time.
43 years.
Yeah, to get the rest of the human remains. I often used to go down to, in my role as Mungo Joint Manager at the ER, I used to take elders down to Canberra, and when the scientific people used to study those remains, you know, I know they've got a lot of information from them, from human remains. And I said, look, modern technology, even our mobile phones only last for about 12 months, and there's something else crops up again. I said, it's going to change. You know, we're going to keep studying our human remains down here. Or, you know, they should be home without. Canberra's not home for me. Just go and walk around that cement city, and it's never any good. You know, I didn't feel at home there, and I was always pleased to leave the place. We'd go down for about 3 days. It was long enough for me. But our demo human remains down there for 43 years, you know. And they wouldn't have any rest down there, you know. And I really felt for those human remains. I couldn't sit up in that room. Them scientific people were studying them even. I just had to walk away. And
so where do you think, what should happen with those remains now? Do you think it's, you're obviously very happy that they've made it back from Canberra. Where do you think would be a more appropriate place for them?
The more appropriate place, I believe, is put them back where they come from, back in the ground, and then they'd have the proper rest. Not in a dark little room. I don't believe it's where they should be kept. I don't know how long they're going to keep them in there for. I mean, as I said, I've been out there for 9.5 years, and I've been in that room about 5 or 6 times in all the years I've been out there. It's just cold, dank, and Mungo ladies in there, and not that I'm spiritually and socially and emotionally, you know. I think about those things, and even on the trip, I come back, I was a bit drained, felt drained, and a lot of different emotions going through me body. Like,
can you tell me what happened? Like, it's been a huge week. You went to Canberra and on a bus. With the elders and Jim Bowler and his wife and a few other people. Can you tell me about a few things that happened along the way?
When we was in Canberra, removing them from the museums, there was a lot of words said down there. We had a sort of a send-off ceremony, a smoking ceremony when we was leaving Canberra, and I'm thinking, it's finally happened, you know, it's finally happened. We're going to take these human remains home where they belong. I felt really glad, and I felt sad. Different types of emotion was going through me. And even on that bus, you know, I couldn't settle. I was wriggling around, and go and sit up with the other fellow to have a talk, and I'd go back to my seat. But it was a big coach and comfortable, and yeah.
So it was quite a different experience for you.
Emotionally wise, it was an epic journey to me. It's a great journey, but to be on that coach and think what we're doing and bringing these human remains home, and I was down there for 43 years, and that's a lifetime for people. Like Aboriginal people, only got a short lifespan. It's a proven fact. And we lost a lot of elders, and I was thinking about some of those elders when we was on that bus that we lost. That'd have been great, you know, to have them sitting beside me on this journey, bringing these old
people. Your auntie and Alice Kelly.
Auntie Alice Kelly and Auntie Tibby Bry and Auntie Elsie Jones. Them was the four old ladies who was instrumental in setting all these committees up, getting all this employment for people out there within the parks. They'd not only dealt with the scientific mob, they dealt with the bureaucratic government, these like national parks. They're talking to regional managers and people with these $10 words that they didn't understand, but they sat there and talked them down, and this is what we want. And they finally got what they wanted. Yeah, so really proud too for them, old girl, and for what they'd done.
You said an interesting thing to me when I rang you up when you were on the bus. You said, what about your guts?
Yeah, it was sort of bubbling, I think, in the
your guts were
there.
Bubbling?
Yeah, well, that's the only way I could explain it, you know. Sometimes it was jumping, and when I was thinking about it, you know, probably emotions going all the time when I was in that bus, and Yeah, have a bit of a sleep and a wake up and think about it again.
And so you went to Wagga, and you had special ceremonies in each town that you went to. What were some of the memories you've got that were incredible experiences when you went to the different towns?
Well, Hay really surprised me. All those people in Hay, when they turned out, and
how many people were there? Do you
think? Oh, I reckon it'd have been 300 people there, and kids, there was even children there, and that was great to see. And all these children there interested in this Mungo man, you know, and what we had in them.
In the hearse. Mungo man hearse.
Yeah, you know, and all these children are sitting around on the lawn, and when we're driving up there, what a fine way to greet something as significant as this, you know. So what a way to greet them, you know. It was a bright, sunny day, and so that was really good there, and hey, I enjoyed that.
And what other towns did you go through?
Banrenal. I went through Banrenal.
Did you get a good welcome there?
Yeah, they had a good welcome. I think at the summer, I didn't actually go out. But I stayed with my old mum. She's in the old home up there in Banrenal, old people's home. And so I spent a couple of hours with her. It was a good opportunity, and I tried to explain to her that
Mungo
man finally come home. And
was she happy?
Oh, well, she was sort of laughing, and yeah, I don't know whether she understood or not, cause, but it sounds like she did, you know, because I kept telling her about it.
Mm.
Yeah, she knew I was working at the parks, you know, for 20 years, and she was happy when I got the job at it.
She must have been very happy.
Yeah, she was.
Working on country.
Yeah.
So yeah. Then, the culmination was at Lake Mungo on Friday, where the remains were brought back in the Mungo Man hearse, which has been an old hearse used by the Aboriginal Burial Service. And it was an amazing day, wasn't it? What are some of the memories that will stand out that you'll tell your great-grandchildren about when down the track?
One of the things I will tell them about is, I suppose, I'd like to know, to let them know about the journey home and how long it took to get them home.
Mm.
I think to get them to understand about the fight them old ladies had, and the respect they should be given to people like that.
But the ceremony on Friday, was there anything there that happened that really moved you?
I think that wind, when I was talking.
When you were making speech?
Yeah, it's wind, and I sort of lost the plot. What happened? And I'm not really nervous when I talk to people, but I didn't really feel.
The wind whipped up.
Yeah, the wind whipped up and blew all that ash over me, and I couldn't see what I was reading there for a while, so I was thinking, what's going on here? But yeah, must have been the spirit. I think them old people now reckon it was a sign, I think, because it was calm until that whirly was in there. And, yeah, so.
A very memorable day.
Yeah, it was a great day.
And last night was a big celebration, a big concert in Mildura, and Indigenous people came from all around the world. Was there anything surprising about last night? That
all them other Aboriginal people who got up and spoke, and you know, just where they come from, all over Australia, nearly, you know, they're talking and been invited down and happy to share this occasion with us. They realise the significant and how important it is to the Aboriginal elders of Mungo, you know, the traditional owners of Mungo, they just realised. And you sit there and think, these people come a long way just to do this, and I'll be part of the celebration, and it means so much to them. You know, and how much more does it mean to the people who are traditional owners? They can't get that feeling, there's something wrong. Yeah.
Was it good to share that feeling with other people?
I think it's great to share it. And it's great to see other different tribal clans come and talk like they did about Mungo Man and other human remains. It's great to hear them speak. I'm sure they'll take those memories home too, of our tribal clans, the three traditional tribal groups, which responsible for the management and the care and control of
so,
these.
So what do you hope rights. Will be happening down the track? A better place for...
A better place for those human remains. And I think the best place for them was, for me, to be back in the ground. That's the way I feel. And I'm sure them old people wanted to get them home and put them back to where they come from. They didn't come from those cold, dark rooms.
And your great-great-great-grandchildren, what do you want them to see when they go back there?
I believe they'll always see the history of Mungo. It's recorded enough. And I know there's, as I said, there'll be newfangled gadgets coming out in the next 10 years. New ways to study bone or bone matter and the age of anything. So there'll always be better ways to do things, I think. So, and I'd like to see my great, great, great grandkids know the true history of our people, the plight, fight that we had to endure. Even growing up as a young man, there was always those people, you know. When I used to go away, I was a good sports person. I tried to be the best at what I've done, whether it be football, tennis, or running, or whatever. But I remember going to parks once, they took us down on a train and waiting to get billeted out. And probably 150 kids there. I think me and about 10 other Aboriginal people was last to get billeted out. I think the headmaster had to take me home to his place, you know. Then you're thinking, what's it all about, you know? Why do they do this to people? I mean, you know, it really hurt me, but, you know, you think about it. You know why they didn't take me, because you're an Aboriginal person and they don't want any Aboriginals in their home. But that's growing up. I remember my brother, he got selected for Australian schoolboys playing football, and he went to Dubbo and he was selling tickets at a grand final to raise money to go overseas. They wouldn't buy tickets for him at the grand final, you know, because they reckon he'd spend it there. That sort of behaviour, you know, towards our people. Really, it's cutting, hurts deep. You still go on. I thought I strive to be the best, even working. I try to be a manager or be up there with the best of them because of this sort of behaviour, what you get with people, you know. I started as a junior porter on the railway when I was 16 and a half. And I had 25 years with the railway in different positions. I know we get treated fairly bad as Aboriginal people because we are what we are. And people can do that.
So were you with railways before national parks?
I was. I had 25 years with railways. And so I've been a public servant, you know, for nearly 45 years. I spent most of my life working with the government departments. And even on the railways, you see your track managers and that, you know, the way they treat people differently, Aboriginal people anyway. They talk down to you all the time. I reckon you can't compete. Be up there with them. When I used to hit the books and prove them wrong. And, you know, I was even bossing my old father, and he was on the railway nearly 33 years. You know. But he didn't want to be a gang, he only wanted to be a fettler. That's all he'd done.
On the tracks.
On the track, yeah. Yeah. So I worked in two different positions. I was a porter, then a senior porter. Then I become a train guard on the railway. I've done that for about 6 months and I left it for a while. Then my old man was a fettler and he finished as a fettler and he had 33 years on the railway. But he was happy doing that. He earned enough money to feed us. So,
when you got married and had kids. How many kids have you got?
I've got 4 children, 2 boys, 2 girls.
What are their names?
Kenny, he's the eldest. He's 39. And Casey, it's another girl, and Amanda, 2 girls, 2 boys. And Ashley, he's in Wagga. So even when I was working on the railways, Kenny was going to school in Orange, because being in a little community, I needed my kids to get a better education and isolate, I was thinking, you know. Because I'd done a lot of reading and a lot of books and to get where I got. No, but,
so school didn't help you much?
Oh, no, I don't reckon it did.
What year were you when you left school?
I was in 6th class. I was doing secondary through a correspondence course. They didn't have a secondary teachers in Ivanhoe, but they were very casual about your schoolwork anyway. You'd stack it in your cupboard and for 6 months. You sent your work back, yeah, it's all gone. There'd be 6 months' work in the cupboard there. And they didn't really worry whether you'd done it or not. So.
So you wanted your kids to go away.
Yeah, and get a better education. So Kenny was in Orange going to school. Casey was in Adelaide doing high school down there. Amanda was in Mildura. Only had my youngest fellow with me, and he's only about 12 when I left there. Ashley.
And where were you living at the time?
I was living in Ivanhoe in a railway out there.
And was it a good decision, do you reckon, sending me? Were they at boarding school?
Oh, I was staying with family. I had family in Orange.
Good decision to send them away.
Well, it's got a better education than I had, I think. So I think it is. It was, yeah.
And your wife's name?
Margaret, yeah.
How did you meet her?
Ivanhoe is a little town.
And is she Barkindji as well?
No, she's a white person. Yeah. I mean, all the Barkindji, all the Aboriginal person seems to be your cousin. So I'm thinking, no, I won't marry my cousin.
And so, what did you like about Margaret?
She's like me, like what we had. She liked the sports, and I liked sport.
And she's gone along to the meetings about the Mungo Man.
Yeah, she always supported me. She's a very supportive woman. We've married now 38 years together for about 40. We had a couple of years together before we got married. So.
Do any of your other kids work on the land or with national parks?
My son Kenny works with national parks. He's been there. We shared an office together. I was there for about 4 years, and then I took redundancy a couple of years ago, and I enjoyed working with my son, and he's pretty clever with his computer skills and that.
And your other kids,
They're both married now with the kids, and Amanda spent 12 months over there with National Park. She could have went a long way, but she ended up pulling out, and yeah, she's got a couple of boys now, and that's all she does, raise them.
And were they all the Mungo celebrations on Friday and the concert last night?
My two sons were. Yeah.
So it's been a big week.
It has been a great week. And we had the best results we could have ever had, getting them home. But then, as I said, we need to follow up on it. We've still got a long way to go yet. But then, I don't think I'll be happy until we do get them all and put them all in back where they come from, even the Mungo lady.
And have you got anything else you'd like to say before we finish this interview?
Well, I was just pleased to be invited back out to Mungo and be part of the excursion to Canberra. But now I am working this Barkindji Native Title Group as deputy chair. So we'll be following up on it anyway.
And how long has the claim for native title been going for the Barkindji?
About 18 years it took us to get a determination.
And what was that?
It was the biggest determination in New South Wales. So it's really a big run from Louth. If you know, Louth's other side of about 80 k's the other side of Wilcannia, going north towards Bourke. And then we go right up around Moolawindji, up to Broken Hill, right out of Wentworth, right around out of Munga. So it's a really big claim. But so we didn't include...
How many acres or hectares or...
Oh, not off the top of my head,
but it's thousands of miles.
Well, it's from Wentworth to Wilcannia, up past Wilcannia to Louth. But the Barkindji country runs right up to Bourke, other side of Bourke. So we didn't include all... The claimants didn't include all the Barkindji country in their claim. So we're currently working on being a bit more inclusive and including that in the claim area.
And so that's the first stage has been proved?
The first stage has been proved. There's a determination over it.
But you've got connection to land.
Yeah.
And what happens next?
It's been proven in the High Court. We've been, a couple of us directors went up to Sydney and spoke in the High Court up there, and but they already... give us our determination in Broken Hill, but we still had to go to Sydney to the High Court. It's up on about the 22nd level, the High Court of Australia. And
how did you feel when that was read out?
We had to make a statement and do it, but sort of read something out to the judge. But it's our concern, not only land, the waters too, you know. The waters, the river is very important to it. So when we say Barkindji, Barker means the Darling, Governor Darling, you know, doesn't mean much to us. That's just a name to us, but the Barker, that's our river, that's the Darling River. And when we say Barker, it's that river. And when we say Inji, it means belonging to. So when I say Barkindji, that means we belong to that river. We don't own the river. That river owns us as Barkindji people. And we talk about the flows in the river. I said when I was a young fellow growing up, it was always full of water. There seemed to be heaps of water in the Darling. The Barker seems to be heaps of water in the Barker. But now when you go up there, Wilcannia, Minindi, there's only a trickle in it. There's hardly any water. You can walk across most places. Yeah, it's terrible, our river. But it's cotton grows, I think, further north. Taking all our water.
Yeah, the community up and down the river are very angry about it as well.
Yeah, for sure. It's a proven fact. When the river's full, there's the crime rate drops in places like Wilcannia, Burr, and Minindi. The crime rate drops in the township when the river's full of water. When it's like it is, the crime rate's goes up because the kids have nothing to do for them. Because they love fishing and swimming and going to the river. Mm.
So when, what happens next in relation to the land claim? Is that it or?
Oh, no, we're only just started really. There's lots of work.
Yeah. So
what? It's extinguished a lot of the water rights and we're going working through them slowly. And
so what do you, what are you aiming for eventually to be able to?
I think we need to, what I'm aiming for is give something positive back to our younger ones.
So leave to be able something. To use that land for different purposes.
To hunt, gather, like we used to do years ago. Go to the river, have it full of water, have access to the river. There's hardly any access to the Barker. It's all fenced off and locked gates. I suppose what I really want is determination to be recognised and treat us as the landowners we deserve to be treated as, and leave something, some land, get some land back so our kids can manage it and to be able to go out and teach them culture on our country and be welcomed on that country, not kicked off what they do to us now.
So do you think, you were saying that things were really tough when you were growing up. Do you think things have improved for your kids and your grandkids?
Yes and no. there's still a lot of people out there with those sort of attitudes. And they'll always be out there. You can't change their attitude or their way of thinking about people or Aboriginal people even coming here. I couldn't get a place to rent. And I said to my wife, you go and try. First place you went to, she got it. And I went to about seven or eight, so.
What's that recent?
Oh, well, it's probably about, when I had the young fella out there, he just wouldn't do school there, actually. I used to try to show him and he'd tell me, you know how to do it, you do it, Dad. Jump on his motorbike and then he'd be gone. I said, he's gone for it, he'll have to go to town. Get him into a proper school, so my wife moved into town. After getting a flat, but that was probably 12 years ago, we tried to get someone to stay and we couldn't. I couldn't anyway, until I sent my wife in. And so the thinking's still out there. And Aboriginal people still have problems getting home in Mildura, rental homes anyway. Seen it often enough.
Well, thank you very much, Warren, for sharing your story. No other little things you'd like to say?
It's a lot I want to say, but I can't.
You
know, no, I probably would have, but, you know, leaving the most important things out, what you'd like to say, and then, you know, why didn't I say that?
Is there anything there in your brain now? Not off the top of my head, no, mate.
I can't think of anything, but it's been good anyway, talking to you.
Been great listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.